We come in this third lecture to section three of part one of the course, and by way of prolegomena or introduction to historical theology, we want to talk about a general overview of historical theology. First of all, I want to give a chronological overview and talk about, under that, first of all, about historical theology as a whole. In the span of 20 Christian centuries, there are at least two clear, recognizable, broad transition points in historical theology. There's the transition of the 5th century and the transition of the 16th century. Two ways of dividing, of course, that corresponds to 5th century Creed of Chalcedon, Augustine, and his pivotal influence for the next 1,100 years on the church. In the 16th century, of course, you know, as the century of the Reformation. Now, two ways of dividing the history of the church have claimed broad allegiance from church historians. The first divides the history of the church into four periods: early church, medieval church, Reformation church, modern church. And I think from the standpoint of, you know, pure church history, that has a lot to be said for it. But if you're looking at church history from the standpoint of historical theology, I think it is preferable to think of three major periods: early church, Augustinian church, modern church. Early church through the year about the year 400. Augustinian church, called that because the influence of Augustine sets the theological agenda all the way through the Reformation. And then I will take medieval church all the way through the Reformation, and then talk about post-Reformation to modern church as the third major period of historical theology. In the curriculum of this seminary, we have chosen to require four courses to satisfy the requirements for church history. They, however, are not equivalent to the fourfold depth vision mentioned above. They're rather equivalent to the second division, but with the addition of a course on Baptist church history. Thus, the historical theology curriculum, as you can see, is historical theology 1, early church, circa 100 to 400. Historical theology 2, Augustinian church, circa 400 to 1600. Historical theology 3, modern church, circa 1600 to the present. Now, that's not perfect. There's a lot of reason to begin modern church with the 1700s and the onset of the Enlightenment as well. At the same time, I do think that from a historical theological standpoint, the questions that begin to get raised and discussed, particularly with regard to the doctrine of the church and the doctrine of eschatology, begin to get raised in the 1600s. And by the early 1600s, the issues related to soteriology, which characterize and dominate the entirety of Augustinian church, are beginning to be settled. Yes, I know the Great Confessions, Westminster's middle of the 1600s, but the Arminian controversies and the Emeraldian controversies in the Reformed churches really are settled by the early 1600s. And especially by the time of the canons of Dort in and around 1610 or so. So that's the divisions of historical theology as a whole. I want to talk about early church in particular. One, the boundaries of the early church period. Of course, it must be recognized the history does not normally, even rarely, provide us with built-in dividing points. There was no sign reading 23 years to medieval church on the road of church history in 377. Assuming this, however, the fact remains there are good reasons to begin and end the study of the early church at certain points. I take the beginning of early church history not from the advent of Christ or even from Pentecost, because I think there's something unique as a cessationist about the apostolic period. Therefore, I prefer to begin early church history in the period subsequent to the apostolic period, the period of the apostolic fathers. And this is to say that I believe that we ought to begin church history proper around 100 AD after the last apostle John had died. So around AD 100 is the terminus ad quo. From that point on, the church was left with no living authoritative human voice to guide it. The first uninspired literature of the church, which we possess, also dates from approximately 100 A.D., a little sooner, a little later. B, the ending point, the terminus ad quem, to use the Latin. This may be conveniently placed in the general vicinity of the middle of the 5th century, and I think I'm going to even argue for the beginning of the 5th century, that is to say around the year 400. But there are good reasons for this. 451 was the year of the Council of Chalcedon. Though this is called the Christological Settlement, in actuality, debates over the person of Christ proceed deep into the medieval period. Thus, though the doctrines of the Trinity and the person of Christ are closely related, it seems best to include the discussion of the Trinity in the early church period and the discussion of the person of Christ in the Augustinian period. Second, the 5th century marked the practical end of the Roman Empire in the West. Rome was sacked in 410. Augustine then wrote the reflection on the sacking of Rome called The City of God in 411. Romulus Augustulus, the last figurehead emperor, was deposed in 476. That is to say, the last Western emperor. And thus, around the middle of the 5th century, the corner was turned from the imperial church to the papal church in the West, and with the decline of the empire in the West would come the ascendancy of the Roman bishop, and the rise of the Roman bishop as not only ecclesiastical but also cultural and secular ruler. Third, the 5th century saw the completion of Augustine's work. His work, especially with regard to the doctrines of man, free will, and salvation, laid the foundation without which neither the Middle Ages nor the Reformation are comprehensible or thinkable. In fact, they also laid the foundation through his arguments with the Donatist for the sacramental controversies that are going to dominate the Middle Ages as well, and also dominate the argument between the Protestant Reformation and the counter-reformation of Roman Catholicism. And so, though there was no bump in the road of church history in the early 400s, a great turning point, a great curve in the road can be discerned as the church heads into the Middle Ages around the year 400 and with the seminal influence of Augustine of Hippo guiding it. Two, the divisions of the early church period. The early church period may be divided into two sub-periods with the dividing line drawn at approximately 325. So this period, the early church period, may thus be divided into the anti-Nicene and the post-Nicene, or the pre-Constantinian and the post-Constantinian periods. If you do anti-Nicene, post-Nicene, you're talking about the Nicene Council and the Nicene Creed, and then you're going to put it around 325. If you're talking about Constantine and his ascendancy as the first Christian emperor, then you're going to talk about around the year 314 or something like that. But still, right in that period of time. AD 311 was the year of the conversion of Constantine and the beginning of toleration of Christianity, which was completed by around 324. 313 was the year of the Edict of Milan, which brought the church rest from persecution. The conversion of Constantine laid the foundation for the imperial church and the union of Christianity with the state. This was an epochal change indeed. And B, AD 325 was the year of the Council of Nicaea. The Arian controversy, which surfaced around 321, was decided in favor of the Trinitarians at this council. Though many struggles remained on this issue, the Council of Nicaea marked a turning point in doctrinal formulation in the early church period. Well, that's, as I was saying, a kind of chronological overview of church history and historical theology. And I want to come, having talked about that, to the theological overview. I approach these lectures in historical theology believing that James Orr, in his book entitled The Progress of Dogma, was at least substantially correct when he said, "Has it ever struck you then? You'll not find it noticed in the ordinary books, but I'm sure your attention cannot be drawn to it without your perceiving that there must be more underlying it than meets the eye. what a singular parallel there is between the historical course of dogma on the one hand and the scientific order of the textbooks on systematic theology on the other. The history of dogma, as you speedily discover, is simply the system of theology spread out through the centuries. Theology, as Plato would say, writ large, and this not only as regards its general subject matter, but even as respects the definite succession of its parts. The temporal and logical order correspond. The articulation of the system in your textbooks is the very articulation of the system in its development and history. Take, for example, any accredited theological textbook and observe the order of its treatment. What we ordinarily find is something like this. Its opening sections are probably occupied with theological prolegomena, with apologetics, the general idea of religion, revelation, the relation of faith to reason, Holy Scripture, and the like. Then follow the great divisions of the theological system, theology proper, or the doctrine of God, anthropology, or the doctrine of man, including sin, sometimes a separate division, Christology, or the doctrine of the person of Christ, soteriology, objective, or the doctrine of the work of Christ, especially the atonement, subjective soteriology, or the doctrine of the application of redemption, justification, regeneration, etc. Finally, eschatology, or the doctrine of last things. If now, planting yourself at the close of the apostolic age, you cast your eye down the course of the succeeding centuries, you find taking as an easy guide the great historical controversies of the church, then what you have is simply the projection of this logical system on a vast temporal screen. Now, the following table will make clear the extraordinary parallel which Orr is noting. So if you think about the progress of dogma, you see that theological prolegomena, apologetics, scripture, canon, occupy the second and third centuries, with the major movements being the apologists, the Gnostic of Marcionite and Montanist heresies. Then you have theology proper, the doctrine of the nature and especially the Trinity of God in the third and fourth centuries. And then in the fifth century you have anthropology, Augustine, of course, in the Pelagian controversy with the doctrines of man, sin, and grace. And then you have Christology, the person of Christ, fifth to seventh centuries, with the Creed of Council of Chalcedon, the Chalcedonian Settlement, and all the discussion and struggles over Apollinarianism, Nestorianism, Eutychianism, and the Monothelite heresies. Then you have objective soteriology. Here, the doctrine of the atonement, the 11th to the 16th centuries. Anselm writes the great pivotal epical book, really, Cur Deus Homo, Why the God-Man, to talk about the atonement and to develop a doctrine of the atonement that assumes its necessity. And this culminates in Luther's understanding of the atonement as necessary in light of the justice of God. And then you have objective soteriology, the 11th to the 16th centuries, and then you have subjective soteriology, the doctrine of the application of redemption, justification, regeneration, 16th century, 17th century, Luther, Calvin, Protestantism versus Roman Catholicism, the doctrine of justification. And so, while it's not perfect, there is a real movement and a logical order to the developments of church history. It would be more difficult to specify the theological developments which dominate more recent history. Suffice to say that the doctrines of ecclesiology, the church, pneumatology, the spirit, and eschatology, the last things, are logically subsequent to the theological loci mentioned above, and they have tended to become increasingly the focus of the church's theological attention, beginning with the 17th century. And so you have the great controversies with regard to the nature of the church and the government of the church, the great controversies that arose with the coming of the charismatic movement, the Pentecostalism over pneumatology, and you have the great controversies with regard to eschatology, and the controversies between amillennialism, postmillennialism, historic premillennialism, and dispensationalism dominating the last couple of centuries of church history. And so, as long as we don't press it in some sort of atomistic way, I think we can see what Orr is saying, that there is a progress of dogma in church history, that church history and historical theology is actually a kind of systematic theology writ large across the face of the church. And I think there's something then to what Orr is saying, as long as we're careful not to try to press it in an unrealistic way too far. Okay? Well, that's our third lecture for this evening. Are there any questions then? I don't know how to let people think and not just cut things off before you're ready to ask a question, but you better speak soon or I'm going to start feeling awkward standing here looking at myself and close the class period if there are no questions. All right. Well, there's always email if you have questions later. Thank you very much. You guys have a good evening.